So this is the first lesson having to do with the canons of Dort, which is something that has its 400th year anniversary this year as far as the canons being what was produced, right, the writings that came out of a particular meeting, a church meeting, in Holland in 16, 18, and 19 is when they met. So 16, 18 through 16, 19, just kind of about 6 month period they met, and produced what is the document that has defined the 5 points of Calvinism. So if you went back in your DeLorean, hit 88 miles an hour, and were able to go to Geneva before 1564, before Calvin died, and you got a hold of Calvin, and you could speak to him in French or Latin or whatever else, probably not English very well, and asked him about his 5 points, what do you think he'd tell you? Like this throwing star, this 5-point throwing star? What are you talking about? Yeah, he would have no idea of these 5 points because the whole thing of 5 points developed later, and we're going to talk about how that developed and how we get the 5 points of Calvinism from this Synod of Dort. That's the Synod, the meeting, the church meeting, and then what they produced, their canons. So my hope this morning in this introductory lesson is to kind of paint the picture historically for what's going on as they meet, and ideally kind of tie it in a little bit to the history we were learning with Michael Reeves about the English Reformation, because these different things going on in different parts of the world certainly relate to one another. In other words, what's going on in Holland is important to what's going on in England and so on. There's a lot of cross flow going back and forth between Holland or the Netherlands and England. So the first thing is, you can see there, number one, is the Reformation. So what's our year for, you know, Martin Luther and 95 Theses and all that?
1517.
Yeah, 1517. Now, Michael Reeves, as he was teaching, he's like, hey, if you don't want the dates, just leave them. Sure, good enough. For me, dates are important because they're pins. They're things to hang things on and connect things with. So as your handout goes, on one side, the back side, it turns out, is a minimized outline. Make it nice and easy, just to kind of see where we're at. And then a map below that of what we call the Low Countries, which amounts to nowadays the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, just north of France, just west of Germany, and just south, really, as it moves up toward Scandinavia. I'm trying to think of the Danish word. The Danish folks are from Denmark. Yeah, just south of Denmark there. So this map is going to be useful for us in locating what we're talking about. And chances are pretty high that we don't know much. We don't know much about the Netherlands. We don't know much about the Reformation there and what's going on. And it's all very interesting, and it's worth knowing, certainly worth knowing as background to a theological document, because the canons didn't just descend from heaven any more than the Westminster Confession of Faith did. It's part of a process that men came together to try to do something. They came together to try to answer problems and keep the unity of the church in Holland and so on. And we'll get into that. So that's the handout. The front side has more detail and a lot of dates. The back side has the map and less detail with a couple of dates. So if we're looking at the Reformation beginning in 1517 and really by the end of the 1520s, really going. A lot of fire in the Reformation in the 1520s. If we look at these Low Countries and then, like, locating them, you know, what do you think about the location of these places, the Low Countries? They're Low Countries because they're low. They don't have mountains, oftentimes below sea level, which produces some interesting stories. But anyone been to these places or have anything to say about the Netherlands themselves or Luxembourg or Belgium? I hear they have chocolate there.
And mice.
And mice.
Lace.
Lace. Okay, good. Probably lice too, when it comes down to it. Scabies. Good. There's that. So there's definitely a lot of business that comes through these areas, especially up in Holland. That's part of the story as well. The businessmen and the business interests are part of the story of the Remonstrants, the Arminians, and the Calvinists. Well, the Reformation came in, at least at first, not in its Lutheran form, but in the Anabaptist form. And anyone can tell me something about the Anabaptists generally? It's kind of a catch-all. It's the miscellaneous category of the Reformation. So what, what are they famous for? How do they get the name Anabaptist? Yeah, the rebaptizers from the standpoint of, you know, Western theological tradition, when you're baptized as an infant, that's your baptism. But these folks came up like modern Baptists that are tangentially related to Anabaptists, but they don't come from them. They come from the Puritans that we just studied, by the way. They rebaptized, you know, from the standpoint of the rest of the church. So they were believers Baptist, you know, like Baptists are today. But that's not just it, because in this society, to throw off your baptism as your infant is to throw off citizenship and other things that go on, and to kind of make yourself a nuisance for the state and for those around you. And so sometimes the Anabaptists really took it hard in the Reformation. They were attacked by everybody because what they were doing was undercutting all sorts of things, not just the issue of baptism. I think sometimes Baptists think that way. We've been murdered for years because of our view on baptism. Yeah, kind of. That and things that go along with that in this, you know, late medieval Reformation society at hand.
So has not the church generally proclaimed that there's a heresy or whatever you want
to Sure. It's kind of received Anabaptism or rebaptism as that, a practical problem, a practical heresy maybe. But when in the Anabaptist, the baptism issue actually shrinks into relative, you know, comparative, it's not as important as a lot of other things going on, including largely their eschatology sometimes. They think by their own actions and in this city, we're going to bring in the kingdom of God. And they just make problems where they go. And there's always been like an openness to them in Holland or in the Netherlands. We should even discuss the terminology there. And early on, they kind of made their mark there in the 20s, the 1520s. And then the Lutherans kind of came in the 1530s. But not in huge degree. What really mattered was in the 1540s when the Calvinists started getting in there, when all these missionaries out of Geneva are going into Holland and into the Netherlands, and that really transforms what's going on in the Netherlands and sets it on its course that we're going to be looking at. So when we talk about this area, the Netherlands is probably the proper terminology for the provinces in these little countries that are united. There's a United Provinces, and others peel off. But we oftentimes call it Holland, but Holland is just one of the provinces. That's a main province, and so it kind of gives its name to all. So we use Holland and the Netherlands interchangeably. And then even broader than that, we talk about the Low Countries, which includes these ones in the south. The reason that the Netherlands and Belgium are separate is because of what we're going to talk about, because of how the Reformation hit and how the armies hit and what went on as far as all that went. So there's a division between the north, which becomes the Netherlands, or the United Provinces of the Netherlands, and then Belgium and Luxembourg to the south. Okay. Which is letter C. So in the seven northern provinces, which became the United Provinces we call the Netherlands today, the Reformation in its strongest form is really the Reformed churches, the Calvinists that were coming over, and to the point where that became the national religion. The Reformed Church was the church of the Netherlands. And I'm not sure if it still is or not. I'm not sure how that goes. I suspect it is. Maybe someone can fill me in, or I can get filled in later. By the way, there's a lot of this I don't know. I don't know a lot about Dutch history. I'm trying to fill in the gaps and set this up. So I'm interested in questions, and you may very well have me repeat the question and say, I don't know, but I can find out. There's that. Okie dokie. With the Reformation, to get to number two, came war. Seems like warfare followed the Reformation to the point where the whole century after the Reformation, ending in 1648, was just a bloodbath. Europe's descended into warfare almost everywhere. We were talking about that a little bit on the way here, and Calvin says, well, why can't people just move? In other words, if the Spanish are coming in and you know, laying siege to the cities, why don't you just leave the Netherlands? But of course, that's a lot easier said than done, always. You know, moving is hard, but people did move. They moved to another place, and there was warfare there. And so there's warfare all around. And again, you remember the Civil War in England. Right? That's part of the Westminster reality, is that England's at war with itself when Parliament calls Westminster Assembly. That was part of the instruction from Michael Rees. There's war everywhere. And we're going to look at one war here called the 80 Years' War, because it lasted about 80 years. And factored into what's finally called the 30 Years' War, which runs from 1616 to 48, 1618 to 48. And that's just tremendous death and carnage all around. It's worse. It's as bad as it gets. Napoleon's wars don't manage to get that bad. World War One does, which is World War One is just a grave over there in Europe. So it's along those kind of lines. Major warfare, lots of bloodshed, and moving into not just armies out there fighting, but armies coming into the city and just killing everybody. They come through the city and everybody is worth killing. That kind of stuff, which moves it into more modern warfare, which is unfortunate. Okay, so the Dutch, these people in these provinces that are linked together, are seeking independence. Independence from whom? Who are they fighting? Who rules over these provinces? Who is the major ruler of Central Europe? Sure. So the Holy Roman Empire is a Central European kind of Germanic power, but sometimes the emperor is selected by electors, right? And so it doesn't just move like a dynasty down to father to son. It moves from person to person and house to house, which is all kinds of international political intrigue going on with that all the time in European history. Counts here too, because who's the Holy Roman Emperor that Luther had to do with? Anybody remember his name? Yep, it's Charles V. Charles V, and he has kingdoms everywhere, including Spain. So he's a Spanish king, as well as being all sorts of kings of all sorts of different dominions. And we got to think of that. The Holy Roman Empire isn't like some solidified political system. There's an emperor who rules over all sorts of different kinds of kingdoms and fiefdoms, and so it's a scattered mess of a reign for the Holy Roman Emperor. But he came. Charles V has roots in the Netherlands and kind of liked them and didn't really bother them that much. He went around bothering all sorts of folks around Europe because he was a Roman Catholic and he didn't like this Protestant thing. He really didn't like the Lutherans, and so went to war with them, even went to war with the Pope different times, but didn't make war on the Netherlands. He kind of left them free, and as the Reformation settled in there, it wasn't something that he addressed in the Netherlands. Now, at a certain point, I put the date there, the 27th of August in 1556, he abdicated. He stepped down. He said, I'm not going to be the emperor anymore. I'm going to go hang out in a monastery for the rest of my days, which didn't amount to too many. And one of his sons, Philip II of Spain by name, became the Holy Roman Emperor. Now, Philip really didn't like what was going on in the Netherlands. And so he's the one who kind of turned and says, okay, well, we got all this heretical Calvinism flourishing in all these different cities in the Netherlands. And, pretty close to when he became the emperor, they also had, I'm trying to think of the Dutch word, and I don't know any, but like an iconoclastic thing that went on, where they went into the churches and tore down a lot of the art, tore down a lot of the statues, and that's happening all around the Netherlands in all sorts of different cities all at once. It's kind of flash, and that provokes the powers to say, okay, enough of this, enough is enough, you Calvinists have had your time, and we're going to march our armies in, and it's going to be over. Right, so that's the Holy Roman Emperor is now going to make war on the Netherlands to bring them to heel. So that's Philip II of Spain. You can see he died in 1589 or 1598 in your notes there, and was married to Bloody Mary. So how about that for a nice connection? So the one who was running the Protestants out of England at the time is married to this Spanish royalty who happens also to be the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. So you can see the power arranged against the Protestants. And from time to time, we certainly saw that in England with Brother Reeves. Okie dokie. I put that he appointed the Duke of Alva, and that's the name that goes down in history with much derision as a guy who just made domestic warfare and slaughter, come into town and just slaughter everyone in there because it's a Calvinist town, so it just goes down. Remember Chris Lynch telling a story of the armies of Alva coming into town and the father taking a pig and slicing its neck by the front door and brushing the blood out from under the door and just kind of leaving the door cracked. And so as the soldiers came by, they looked, so our job's done there. Right? The blood's coming out of the house, so we've already been in there. Next house, right? That kind of thing, where it's just bloodletting. And if you've seen The Patriot, right? With, what's the guy's name? Gibson, right? They're, okay, the guy who comes in and he's brought in by the general, I can't remember his name, to basically just make, I can't think of the right kind of word, but warfare on the people, right? Take it on the people, and he says, well, if I do that, I can't stay here, I gotta have a place back. That's the kind of guy Alva was. He's going in there and he's gonna just let some blood and let it flow. So he did that for a handful of years. And of course that, you know, everyone hated that. And everyone now hates Philip even more because of that kind of warfare being made. And a guy from Orange in southern France, you can see there, I spelled it in Dutch, Willem van Orange, but William of Orange is the one who comes in and provides some political unity and military strength against the Spanish, and earns himself a tremendous place in Dutch history as being the father of the fatherland. So a tremendous man, and important for English history as well, as he becomes, for a little while, the King of England. So he's an interesting Protestant, and of course he grew up Roman Catholic, but kind of had a conversion here right in this period when the armies are coming in, and was able to be God's man for them to protect them and raise up a savior, almost like in the book of Judges. So that's William of Orange. Keep your eye on him because he'll come back around time to time. Okay, so we have this 80 years war, and it's called that after the fact. No one said, hey, let's get to start the 80 years war. We'll count it out. That's not how it works. It's always looking back to give a name to it. But they did call for a 12-year truce. In the moment. That is the powers with the, you know, the vying powers of the northern seven provinces of the Netherlands bind together and vie for a peace, which they have. And in that peace, they're able to build up their economics, build up their business, and finally have some prosperity back because this war just depletes everything. You know, war takes, in case we didn't know that, war takes a lot of money. And you know what it does with money? It burns it. That's what war does with money. We think sometimes there's so much that develops out of our spending on war, and you know there are things that develop out of it. But you take a bomb, you put money to make the bomb, you drop it, and it blows up and destroys other things. So war is very destructive. It isn't good for the general economy, except for the war machine economy. So they had this 12-year truce, which goes from 1609, look at those dates, to 1621. Now, right kind of toward the end of that is the Synod of Dort. That's when it's happening. And I mention that there because this truce, you know, it's like, okay, in a few years, we're going to be back at war with Spain. And inwardly, internally in the Netherlands, that's kind of coming apart in their hands, risking civil war, particularly over Arminius, his followers, and that's what brings about the Synod of Dort, to try to keep the unity of the Netherlands together, the United Provinces, so that when they have to go back to war in a year or two, they're not going as a fractured body and divided and so on. So I hope that's really part of the impetus of bringing the Synod together is for unity in the provinces against Spain because they're going to be going back to war. Anyway, any questions on that? I think it's a helpful piece to say, well, why are they doing this? Why are they worried so much about, you know, this theological debate? And the reason they're worried about the theological debate is it's tearing apart the church, and the church is part of the state apparatus. Right, so it's really, there's a threat going on here, civil war among the United Provinces. So it makes the Synod of Dort kind of a peacemaking, at least an attempt at keeping peace and unity. Okie dokie. Yes, sir.
So the 1621, the connection between was where the Pilgrims, they went to one place and then they came to America from there. That was in the Netherlands too.
You bet. Yeah.
About the same time, and getting some motivation to
leave. Yeah, and I'm not sure even where they landed, what the deal was there, but the Netherlands have always, they've been more open to, say, religious or philosophical diversity than most other places in Europe. And that's, I think, why the Brownists and those separatists from England were able to sail down, you know, somewhere in Holland here, somewhere in the Netherlands, and find a space, but it's a space that was not where they wanted to be, so they went across the pond. So that's another connection here to the English and American experience, too. Any other thoughts? Okay. So that's maybe a political background to the Synod of Dort and what they're trying to do. Keep that in mind with the warfare and so on. It's worth thinking all these Reformation creeds and catechisms are all generated out of highly political and oftentimes in the midst of war. Right? They're not. It's not theologians sitting at their desk in peace and prosperity. It's theologians at work in the midst of trials and difficulties. Even like we learned about John Owen with all his kids dying and all that stuff. He's living life and he's living a hard life. Yet he's rejoicing in the Lord. And I think that's what these Christian brothers are doing here too. Okay, so the theological movements in the Netherlands. Again, the church in the Netherlands is reformed. The state church, So it's the Church of Holland, the Church of the Netherlands, and it is a Reformed church. And it takes the Heidelberg Catechism and the Belgic Confession, which are, you know, a large catechism we went through when I first got here, the Heidelberg Catechism, and then the Belgic Confession, which is this kind of a basic confession of faith, written by a guy named Guido de Bray, who was a martyr for this thing. And he largely copied Calvin's French confession coming out of Geneva, which is just, again, just a confession of faith. Here's our Christian beliefs, and try and lay them all out, just like Westminster does. Try to take it from beginning to end and do it all and present, you know, a confession of the faith. So we have those two, and they end up being two pieces of three, which we call the three forms of unity. So the German Reformed churches, the Dutch Reformed churches, they operate under documents kind of like we do as Presbyterians. We have the Westminster Confession of Faith, and then the shorter and larger catechisms would be our forms of unity, right? The doctrinal standards that we're held to. Well, the churches in the Netherlands, they were operating under the Heidelberg Catechism and then the Belgic, Heidelberg Catechism and Belgic Confession. And finally, what we get here from the Synod of Dort, they produce their canons, and that becomes a third of the three forms of unity that have been definitive for continental Reformed churches. So by continental, we mean from the continent of Europe as opposed to from the islands, say English and so on, and Irish. So we talk about the Continental Reformation and then the British Reformation from there, or the Scottish Reformation. Okay, any questions on those documents or how they've maybe functioned? So we have a Reformed church, and that has from the level, and I think maybe I put it in there. Oh, just right above there. Consistory, classis, and synod. So they had the same kind of structure that you see in Presbyterian churches, where the consistory is the same thing as a session. Right? Session means sit. Consistory means sit together. So those words just mean the same thing. The elders sitting together. And that's on a local level. And then they have a presbytery. They call it classis. And the Dutch Reformed still talk this way. It's still how they talk about their form of church polity. And then above that would be the general synod. The synod of the church, the Reformed Church of the Netherlands. So they have the same kind of Presbyterian system kind of that we enjoy now, but it was for the whole country, right? It was the state church of the Netherlands, kind of like the state church in England, except the state church in England had a different shape. It wasn't Reformed. It was Episcopal, right? It's drawn from the Roman Catholic style of government, a different form, different shape of authority in the church. So these are more thoroughly Reformed in how we'd like to see church polity or church government going. Any thoughts on that before I move on from just the church government? And it's a Reformed church in the Netherlands, and that's the state church. Anybody think that's a good thing? I kind of like it. There are some reasons not to like it, but I kind of like it. Yeah. Good. The question is, how does the Catholic Church work in? And the answer is not officially or overtly in the society, but when Philip's coming in with his armies, they're Roman Catholic. Spain is Roman Catholic, right? The Holy Roman Empire is Roman Catholic. So that's part of the problem. It's not just we want political freedom or we want economic freedom, but it's all tied in with ecclesiastical church stuff too, because if they get in here and run us over, we got to submit to the papacy again. They're gonna push that on us and destroy the churches, not only doctrinally, but formally, right? The polity too. So within Dutch society, and it moves through time, because there's a lot of freedom given. They're one of the handful of places in Europe Jews could be together, right? They had their own ghettos. They're in, like they almost always are, they're in their own spot, but they were free to live there and practice within their ghettos and so on. You don't get that in England. Remember, they're out for hundreds of years in England. They're gone. And other places too. So there is freedom, and I'm not sure how far it extends to Roman Catholicism. My guess is not that far, because it's so tied in with the enemies they're attacking, where the Jews aren't, right? You know what I mean? And other weird philosophical and spiritual things aren't tied in with that attacking power of Philip II, which is Rome, backed by Roman Catholicism. So maybe that makes sense as far as, and anyway, that's my way of saying I don't know, but it varies. And it varies through time. It opens up in different ways through time. Good question. No, it's a republic. So they ended up developing, once they kind of got Philip at bay and were able to set up shop, they have some form of republic. I'm not quite sure how it breaks out, but you can see it, and just the ideas here is being prototypes of what's going to happen in America in some ways. So the Republican government, and although in America the church government, all the Puritans that are going over there are largely independents, right? So they would be independent church government rather than Reformed or Presbyterian. But so we see a good thing going on here. It's okay, and with that, a lot of prosperity, tremendous amount of money, and it's so that's in a lot of ways the Netherlands are a great place to be when they're not at war. And often here we see that they are. A good question. Other questions? So let's look here at the development of James Arminius. I got his dates there. You can see he died in 1609, right before it got crazy. Right? I mean, he's kind of the seed, and what he sprouts and germinates is what kind of goes wild in the Netherlands and makes the problems. So Arminius was a Reformed theologian, pastor, and teacher at the University of Leiden. That is, and I remember in college, a professor of mine saying, in fact, one that I was tight with and learned a lot from, that Arminius was a Reformed theologian, which kind of took me aback. I mean, no, he's Arminian. That's not Reformed. But what he's talking about, of course, is the broad Reformed tradition. And within that tradition, here's this theological struggle that's going to go on. And it's not just going on in Holland. It actually is going on all around the world. And it's not just going on in this one time. It's going on through church history. That's something I kind of hope to draw as we go, that when the canons of Dort come and set down their doctrine, most of it is Catholic doctrine and then kind of brings to a fine point where here's the theological issue at bay or in the sites right now. So they're drawing on, these pastors are drawing on long theological traditions that have been at war since the early church and probably beyond that, probably earlier than that as well. In any event, he does his education there in Holland, and then what often happens with these educated folks is they go on, I can't think of the right word, I like to think of it as a parade, around Europe where they're just stopping at different schools. They'll hang out at, you know, famous schools for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months, have their lodging there, meet the professors, learn some stuff, make their connections, and go in. So they kind of do this tour around Europe to important schools, and he did that to any number of schools, and landed in Geneva under Theodore Beza. Theodore Beza was John Calvin's successor, and a wonderful scholar and teacher, and loved Arminius. In fact, wrote glowing reports about this guy as a student. And back off to Holland he goes, or back off to the Netherlands to be ordained, to be a minister, and then finally to teach at the University of Leiden, which is where most of the stuff goes down, the kind of focused like theological struggles right around the University of Leiden in particular. Okay, so he gets there, and there's a debate within Calvinistic circles in this time, within the Reformed Church, having to do with this curious doctrine of the logical order of the decrees of God and God's mind, right? So how God planned things, in particular relative to the fall. So we call this the lapsarian debate. I didn't write this on there, but lapsarian means fall. So we have people that thought that, well, the order of decrees, I guess I should just probably not talk about this that much because we don't have a lot of time, but it's trying to figure out logically, not in time or temporally, but logically what comes first in the mind of God. And is it the fall that comes first in his thinking, or is it election that comes first? So if God in his mind says, I'm going to elect to save certain people and damn others, and then I'm going to make a fall to make that happen. Right? It's kind of thinking that way. Call that a supra-lapsarian, S-U-P-R-A, lapsarian position. And then there's another one called a sub- or infra-lapsarian position, where the decree of creation and fall logically precedes election. So God's choosing logically out of a fallen humanity to receive some, as opposed to choosing to redeem some and damn others before he's even thought about the fall to make that happen, right? So that's maybe some of the nub of this debate. And this is, unfortunately, and I think for my part, it's not a good debate. It's not all that helpful, and it has proved to be divisive and make problems like this one in the Reformed churches. And this one amounted to James Arminius being summoned by Theodore Beza to put forward a defense of supralapsarianism, to give it to a defense in this particular theological debate. And as he studies it out, he goes the other direction. He's like, well, I don't think either of those are correct. In fact, he develops what we call maybe an Arminian theology from there. And one of the problems that happens here is there is no single Arminianism. It's kind of a category for a certain variety of thinking. And in Arminius' day, it's maybe kind of tight. You can say, okay, well, here are the things that bind the Arminians together. But pretty quickly as he dies, it goes all sorts of directions. And so it encapsulates lots of problems. James J.I. Packer wrote an essay called Arminianisms, where he kind of traces these different things, and you know, not all Arminianism is Arminianism. And we talk that way too. We just have it as a category for anyone who, like, you know, thinks much about free will and doesn't talk about the sovereignty of God and salvation and stuff like that. We say, this guy's an Arminian. But that may or may not be the best actual label for him. Okie dokie. So, right after Arminius dies, 1609, this extreme minority, really, a very low percentage of ministers in the Dutch Reformed churches there, produced a document called the Five Articles of Remonstrance. So they're remonstrating, they're complaining that it should be this way. You Reform guys, you Calvinists are thinking this way, but you should be thinking this way, and that's what remonstrance means. So they're called remonstrance by name. That's what the groups would be called, or other things. They wouldn't be called really Arminians till later, mostly. And also, the Calvinists weren't really called Calvinists either, because they all kind of thought they were Calvinists. They all thought they were following John Calvin, really. Arminians did as well. They would be called Gomarists, G-O-M-A-R-I-S-T-S, after, I think I got his name in here. Yep, down there at the bottom, Franciscus Gomarus. And you can see his dates there under number 4. Okay, so quickly, the five things, so they brought up 5 points. This is where the 5 points of Calvinism come, is because the remonstrants brought forth five complaints, or five things that they wanted to say or set the record straight on. And so we can look down these. The first is conditional election. So what is conditional election? We know what election is, right? It's God's choosing, right? Choosing to save people, or possibly to save a class of people, probably closer to what Arminius had in mind. Yeah, it is oxymoronic. So the you know, your tulip, right? The unconditional election would be the counterpart, which is actually where the canons start, is right there, because they're just responding to these remonstrants one by one. But conditional election has the idea that God has elected people from eternity, or elected a class of people, which is, again, moves more that direction. The Calvinists are always talking about individuals, right? People themselves are elect or reprobate, and that based upon God's decision, right? This all comes out of grace. If anyone's saved, they're saved because of the gracious God who elected them. Now, the Arminians want to say, well, all that's based upon bare foreknowledge. In other words, God knowing what's going to happen and therefore decreeing it, which always seems to me to be a strange thing. Like, God's going to go ahead and rubber stamp what the people decide to do. And he's going to do that by way of election and eternal decree. But it kind of defeats the entire purpose of eternal decree. It's God's eternal decree. It's him. Right? Well, it all flows from God, not the other way around. So there are big issues that go on here with the idea of conditional election. So election is conditioned upon you. Right? Upon what you choose. And it's, again, they're not just goofy freewheelers. They're not there. They recognize that men are dead in sin. And we'll get to that as we go down. That's like number 3. But anyway, conditional election is based upon creation somehow. And it might even be just a category. Hey, if you fit the category of having faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, then you're elected. You're part of that category. But in individuals, they might not even talk about that, where Calvinists are regularly talking about individuals and election and so on. The second one is universal atonement. These start to sound very familiar. Christ died for everyone, indiscriminately, each and every one. There's no difference in that respect. Christ came and offered some kind of satisfaction to God that's going to cover everyone in some sense. And so trying to define what that sense is becomes difficult. That's understandable. But that's what they mean by universal atonement. Any questions on those first two? Yeah.
Well, it kind of goes against justification.
Sure. Yeah, so there's some theological things to work out in there. I know one phrase that I read in Calvin kind of shocked me, which comes from Peter Lombard, who's like the great theologian of the Middle Ages with his work Sentences, the major theological text that everyone would have read. He said this: the atonement of Christ was sufficient for all, but efficient for the elect. Right? So using some sense of sufficiency, whatever that's exactly meant by that. But efficient, that is, it works for, it comes to rest in and actually redeem the elect. And that was kind of Peter Lombard's way of stating it. And I read Calvin saying the same thing. And I've heard people say that, but I've never really liked it that much. Because it's hard to talk about the sufficiency of Christ's redemption and atonement apart from what it actually does. Right? That saves people. Christ actually saves sinners. And that's what we're considering. I don't know what the sufficiency beyond that really is, though maybe there's a case to be made there. Jessam?
Yeah, who gathered and produced these articles?
Oh, good. So these were written, the five articles of the Remonstrance were written by a collection of probably like 40 or 50 ministers from the Dutch Reformed Church, right? The Reformed Church in Holland that we're talking about. And again, that's part of the state, right? It's a state-run church, and there's questions about where the state stops and the authority of the church starts. But these are all ministers within the state Reformed Church of the Netherlands that get together as a minority and say, we want some political protection here because we're going to get run out of town. These are things that they're putting forward that they think the Reformed tradition or the Calvinists around them are messed up about, and they're going to set them straight or call for some protection around what they're going to teach. So these five things, these are the 5 points that the Calvinists come back together and say, well, here's what we actually believe, in the Reformed tradition, and you guys are wrong. So the Remonstrants are the Arminians of the day, presenting this Arminian doctrine, and then they're responded to by the Calvinists of the day with the Calvinistic doctrine.
But they're Arminians in the Reformed Church.
Yes. Because that's all they could be, right? And in time here, by the time the Synod comes around, they end up getting booted from their pulpits and taken out of ministry and things like that as well. And parishioners who listen to Arminian teaching get fined. That's pretty funny. They didn't think so, but I do. I think it's funny. Yeah, Tim?
So how closely do these 5 points of the Remonstrance mirror the teachings of Arminius?
Good question. Probably pretty close. One thing about Arminius is he didn't publish much, if anything, before he died. So you got that 3-volume work of the works of James Arminius. I have it, and you can read in there. He's got plenty of great stuff to say, no question about it. But nothing was really published until after his death. And then it all goes wild. So this is pretty close to his death, and I think it probably mirrors his thought with some consistency. The wheels haven't fallen off yet, as far as that goes. So let's finish it up. We're running late here. So number 3, the primacy of grace and the sinful inability of man is something they're saying, hey, we're not Pelagians. We don't believe that men are just free and can choose God. And we're dead in sin and we need God's grace to do anything. All of this is an issue of grace. So they're kind of within the Reformed tradition thinking that way and trying to, again, defend themselves against the accusations that are coming to them. Arminius himself comes up with a doctrine called prevenient grace, or grace that prevents or goes before, where the man's dead in sin, but God comes to every man and gives him enough grace to lift him out of that deadness in order to make a choice. Right, so there's not this issue of we're not dead in sin by nature. Arminians say, yeah, we are. And all the Arminians say, yeah, that's right. But they have other ways of dealing with that rather than the Orthodox Calvinistic way of dealing with it, which is to say God comes to us in regenerating grace in the first step. Right? God gives life. And from that point, then we're alive in Christ and we can function. But that's the Reformed version of it. We're getting there, the Calvinistic.
Does this number 3 for primacy of grace and inability? Does that come close to this idea of total depravity?
Yeah, absolutely. They're right in line on that.
It does not depart from...
Yeah, to the point where in the heads of doctrine that the Synod puts forward, 3 and 4 are put together.
Okay.
Right? And that's why. Because the third one's like, well, we don't have a lot to argue with here. Right? As your statement of the natural inability of man, we agree. So it kind of gets lumped into this idea of resistibility of grace. At what point? Anyway, so that's the fourth thing is the resistibility of, the scripture says that you always resist the Holy Spirit, and the Arminians say, well, see? Say, okay, well, that's not really talking about what we've been talking about. What we're talking about is when God makes a move to regenerate a person, that person's regenerated, right? That person is drawn by God. Even if before they're dead in their sins and unwilling, God makes them willing, right? There's this irresistibility of grace when it comes to conversion, and that's something that the Reformed or the Calvinists are at war with the Arminians here and say, no, the Holy Spirit's resistible. And then on the 5th point, perseverance. So resistible at the beginning of the process, but we're not so sure about the rest of the process. Right? That's kind of how that goes. So the resistibility of God's grace is seen by the Arminians at the beginning. God can raise you up and you can say yes or no, and you can choose or not choose, not out of nature, but still in grace. But then as the whole Christian life proceeds, We're not quite sure how that goes because, you know, some passages make it seem like people fall from faith and leave, and other ones make it seem like Christ holds them, and they're not sure how that pans out. Right? We need more research on this is kind of how they end that one. So it wasn't strictly this, you know, against perseverance of the saints. It was just not quite sure how that pans out, not willing to set it
isn't
down.
Isn't that fifth point related to losing your salvation?
You bet. Yep, that's exactly what it is. So the fifth point is, can you lose your salvation? Can you will yourself out of the grace of God? They're not quite so sure about that. But they're pretty sure that you can will yourself into it by some measure of prevenient grace, not by nature, but by grace. So there's the theological deal they do there to try to make it make sense.
That's part of the condition.
What's that?
That's part of the condition.
Sure. Yeah, in fact, that ties in number one there, right? That you did that, or that God went ahead and seen you doing it and said, cool, I'm going to decree that from back here in eternity.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah, right. Yeah.
It seems like the Achilles heel in that is where it falls to man's ability. Because I can't think of one scripture that would have anything to do with like you were saying. I'm sure they had some scriptures they must have pulled from a religion, so there was a certain amount of grace that would allow you to choose. I don't know how they would come by that, but you're dead or you're not dead.
Yeah, right. And it's, yeah, they're on board with that. But then in the deadness, what does God do and how does he handle us? And trying to make a space in there for the human will being the decisive factor. So the whole thing does just wrap around predestination. The whole controversy comes right down to God's predestination. Is it conditioned upon what he knows humans will do? By his foreknowledge in that sense, which is, by the way, not how the Bible uses the word foreknowledge. It doesn't just bear knowledge ahead of time. It's not how it's used. That's a different thing. But that's what the Arminians are putting forward. That God, using the old phrase, looked down the corridors of time, figured out what was going to go on, and that's the basis, the condition of election. And the Calvinists say, no, it doesn't work that way. Right? So that's the real nub. That's the real, and then the other things kind of wrap around that, how that works and how it goes from there. So
No,
1,000 times no. If you've ever heard Pastor Newman preach, even but once, you've probably heard that story. Anywho, we'll pick it up here next week, and that at least gets us into the theological mix, and then the social mix with the war and Spain and all the stuff that's going on, and that this is very unsettling, right, to the church, the ideally unified church, the Reformed Church of the Netherlands. And so there's a political, martial, theological reasons all built into what's going on in calling the synod. So let's have a word of prayer, and we can prepare ourselves for worship.